Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Yasmeen Ammer in for Tiziana Deering. Let's start today by going back in time, back about 3 years, to the early months of COVID. For a lot of people, the outdoors felt safer, a way to socially distance and avoid getting sick. In response, cities and towns opened up streets and sidewalks for walking, outdoor dining, and rollerblading. Well, now maybe the public health need for outdoors has lessened, but the want to be outside? That's still alive and well, especially as the weather warms up. So municipalities face a choice. Should they keep their new open spaces open, or go back to the way things were? More cars. Here to tell us more, Boston Globe business reporter Diddy Coley, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being on the line, and you've done a lot of reporting on this. So it all started May 2020. We were still trying to understand what the heck the pandemic was and how to deal with it, if you remember. But a lot of cities closed off roads in urban areas to cars, and all that happened kind of quickly. Can you remind us why they made that decision?
So at that point, it was both a social and an economic necessity. I mean, as you said, folks were really trapped at home. They were often quarantining. They weren't seeing their usual friends, family, and colleagues. So cities decided that, you know, just to open public space as a way to gather and just see other people and honestly not lose your mind a little bit. But in a way, it was also a financial need. A lot of businesses were struggling during that time, restaurants, but also service businesses. And just having more people walking around was really a boon for them. And of course, particularly in neighborhoods like the North End, a lot of the neighborhoods in Boston, having a couple extra tables never really hurt.
Mm. And you've done a recent piece, you wrote a recent piece for The Globe about Moody Street in Waltham. So what did that transformation look like?
So Moody Street is an interesting example because it was one of the first places to shut down to cars early in the pandemic. It was pretty novel in that way. And for the past 3 years, they've shut off about a half mile both ways to traffic, to car traffic, for between 4 and 6 months of the year. And the restaurants have been really happy about that. Moody Street has a ton of diverse businesses, but it also has a lot of service businesses. You're talking about barbershops, boutiques, grocery stores, and they don't tend to benefit as much from being pedestrian only. In fact, they really hate to lose the parking, particularly for their senior and disabled customers. So this year, the whole setup was up for debate. There were several proposals made either to do it as years passed, either to open it to cars fully, to do some kind of hybrid. And eventually yesterday, they decided on a bit of a hybrid situation where it's now open to cars during the week and only open to pedestrians during the weekend.
So this is a tough issue because, as you mentioned, some businesses love it and some businesses really hate it. And is that who's driving the main opposition to keeping the roads open? Like some of those businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. They recently did a survey in town of both businesses and residents, and 90% of people were actually in favor of doing a pedestrian-only zone this summer. Huh. But when I went on Moody Street, you know, to talk to businesses, a number of them who have been there for several years, and particularly in Waltham, a number of them who are immigrant-owned, say that this is severely hurting their business, that forcing folks to park even a couple blocks away really hurts them in the long run.
So now there are two proposals, and they you reported on them in the Waltham Traffic Commission meeting yesterday. Tell us about those dueling ideas, like the what now?
So there was one proposal to essentially keep it exactly how it was, but do a 3-year study to actually measure how it hurts businesses, to measure how you can help traffic congestion in local neighborhoods, and to figure out what people are actually saying on both sides of the aisle. That was from Councillor Jonathan Paz. Then the mayor had also proposed something, which was essentially to make that strip of Moody Street one way for cars from Monday to Thursday, and then to make it fully open to pedestrians from Thursday to Sunday. So that way, you know, you still keep some of the parking. A lot of the businesses that are open at the day benefit, but people can still have outdoor patios and outdoor dining on the weekends when it's really busy. Neither of those actually are ending up happening. Last week, the Traffic Commission had a long meeting and they decided essentially to do a kind of like an all or nothing. So either it's during the week, fully cars, or during the weekend, fully pedestrians. And that's what they landed on.
Oh, and is this ruling similar to other decisions you've seen recently in other municipalities about open space? Is it an all or nothing approach?
It's interesting because it seems like folks are trying to find compromise. A lot of the time for local residents, in Starlight Square, for example, that's a essentially opening of e-commerce and programming in a municipal parking lot in Central Square in Cambridge. They're still deciding whether to do it at all. So there, it's either going to happen or the zoning board is saying we're just getting rid of this entirely. So the debate is really still happening in a lot of places. So it's hard to tell how it's all going to shake out in the end.
And I have to say, the debate is happening in my neighborhood. I live right next to Memorial Street in Cambridge, Riverbend Park. Oh my goodness. If you look at the next door debate about that, it gets really fiery. Do you know the latest on that? And there's actually, because there's an interesting debate here. One argument to reopen to cars on Saturday is because they're concerned about elevated traffic and pollution in surrounding residential neighborhoods, and so some of which are classified as environmental justice community. So that's such an interesting argument. It is, you should open it back up to cars because it's congestion for a lot of surrounding neighborhoods. Like, what do you think about that? Do you think that has any legs?
It's tough because that neighborhood of Cambridge is historically Black. And so the NAACP is also involved. And they say for them, this has caused a lot of traffic congestion. So the question is if there's more cars on your street all the time, then perhaps maybe it is an environmental justice issue. But at the same time, you know, people on the other side of the aisle are saying this is really a scapegoat to just open to cars again, because how can it be an environmental justice issue to have people rollerblading and walking and biking on the street, you know, more of the week? So it's interesting whether or not that's actually the case.
Mm. And I've got to say, despite the fact that I live there, I said the name of the Memorial Drive, not Memorial Street.
Yes.
How embarrassing. Perhaps the most high profile of any case in Boston this year is in the North End, because it impacts outdoor dining. That has been such a clash between the mayor and businesses in the North End. Could you tell us about that controversy?
Yeah, so the North End controversy actually goes back to last year. For anyone who's ever been in the neighborhood, you know that it's very dense. The sidewalks and the streets are very narrow. And so when you add outdoor dining on public space, it really lessens, you know, the place for people to walk and drive. So last year, Mayor Michelle Wu decided that the neighborhood could still do outdoor dining, but that they would pay a special fee, which was $7,500 over several months. And that caused really a stir. They thought that was going to help with trash and traffic congestion. It was to appease some of the neighbors who have been complaining. This year, again, technically, the North End is now allowed to bring outdoor dining back, but they have to have adequate sidewalk width, which very few restaurants, if any, have. So essentially, it's taking away outdoor dining for the year and reevaluating it for next year. But the businesses are really unhappy about that going away.
So that was going to be my next question, actually. Like, what can people expect when it comes to outdoor dining in Boston? Like, start with the North End, but just in Boston in general this summer.
In the North, yes. In the North End, it's probably going to be few and far between. You're almost only ever going to see it on the restaurants that already have designated private space where they were allowed to have patios possibly even before the pandemic. But the rest of the city, it's likely that people are going to come out for outdoor dining like they have in years past. Restaurants now have to pay a fee, which is either $199 or $399, depending on whether or not they have a liquor license. But considering the profits that come from having more tables outside, I think the same number of restaurants are going to do it this year as in years past.
So it sounds like the city is trying to formalize and reel in some of the policies for open space that were initially changed quickly, perhaps haphazardly during the pandemic. So how does City Hall hope the new rules will change the way Boston looks and feels and the way people move about the city in your mind?
The way that people have been talking to public space about me is that some of the changes that we made were really the silver lining of the pandemic. So there's widespread consensus that you want to keep some of these programs as they were, or at least, you know, some fraction of what they were, because the social and economic benefits are really, you know, really unheard of and unseen before the pandemic. At the same time, no one was giving any of these initiatives pushback in 2020 or 2021 because it was just such an unprecedented time. So I think city officials are really in the boat of having to balance what their constituents want now. But hopefully that'll still mean, you know, we get to hang out a little bit more outdoors than we did before.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Diddy Coley, Boston Globe business reporter. We're talking to her about this debate about open space outside versus letting cars through, closing streets. Diddy, let me ask you this. What are you going to be watching for in this space going forward? What are the bigger themes you're going to be looking out for?
I think that there are some municipalities who are trying to do more evidence-based study of the actual effects of public space. I mean, a lot of these benefits and drawbacks are so anecdotal right now because cities weren't really thinking about collecting data on all of this. So now when it happens again this year in Waltham, you know, seeing how many restaurants actually come out for outdoor dining this year, that's really going to help inform what this looks like going forward. So that's what I'm keeping my eye on.
And other pieces that you're working on now, not even necessarily related to this directly?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just waiting for the outdoor dining season to open so that I can actually talk to folks about what that looks like. And in terms of kind of, you know, what else is in the pipeline, I'm thinking about downtown retail, which is, you know, really on everyone's mind. What are we actually going to do to fill up all those storefronts?
No doubt. And we'll be looking out for it. Thank you so much for your reporting. Diddy Coley is a Boston Globe business reporter. Really appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court is on deadline to make a ruling by the end of the day on how much access Americans will have to mifepristone, a drug used in medical abortions. If the court doesn't make a decision, then a ruling from the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals will take effect. That ruling would impose multiple restrictions on the medication, including how and when it could be administered and consumed. So with us to talk more about this is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator Warren, thank you so much for joining us and welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
So let me start with this, because on Monday, this coming Monday, you and your colleague, Senator Ed Markey, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, will kick off a 20-stop nationwide bus tour to highlight what you say are ethical lapses and partisan rulings from the Supreme Court, which is going to rule tonight. You are calling for major judicial reform, and I want to know what your objective is in this nationwide bus tour. Like, do you want to sway minds, drum up support, something else?
Yes and yes. So let's back up a little and look at the two kinds of problems we've got in the United States Supreme Court right now. The first one is that we now have an extremist court that no longer seems to feel bound by rule of law. A court whose members swore until the world looked level that they were going to abide by precedent, and then as soon as they got the numbers, overturned Roe versus Wade. A court that has been undermining voting rights, has undermined the rights of unions to organize, just on and on and on. That's one kind of problem, a problem where we've got a court that is undermining democracy and the very way it functions. The second is we've got a court that's got ethical problems, and part of that is structural. The Supreme Court, 9 justices, don't feel bound, evidently, by any ethical rules except how they decide they are going to take gifts, do whatever they want to do.
You're talking about Justice Clarence Thomas and the issues.
We're talking about Justice Thomas.
Specifically, yes.
Oh, that's right, specifically. But we're also talking generally about the whole idea that these justices are not bound by rules on, for example, when they need to recuse themselves. because they have ties to someone who has an interest in a case that is in front of them. Again, we're talking about Clarence Thomas.
Speaking of those changes, you have spoken out for expanding the court. That means putting more than nine justices in. Can you talk to me as Elizabeth Warren, the law professor first and Democratic senator second? Because I'm wondering if in any way, shape, or form you think this could cause an arms race in the Supreme Court. Because couldn't Republicans suggest doing the same thing?
So, look, Elizabeth Warren, the law professor and the senator, the last thing I'd want to do is to start messing around with the Supreme Court. It would take extreme circumstances to push me there. Unfortunately, that's exactly where we are now. And for that, I want to use current legal devices to get this court back into some semblance of how it's supposed to function in a democracy. So I want to pass an ethics law. I've been after this for years now, one that applies to the United States Supreme Court and has real teeth. Mm. I also think it is time now to consider expanding the Supreme Court. And that has been done before. It does not take a constitutional amendment. Yeah. It's happened seven times in the past. And now is a time when I think it's appropriate for us to do exactly that.
You think it's appropriate because in your mind, these are extraordinary circumstances.
Yes.
But so
yes.
Understood where you're coming from. So removing FDA approval entirely, we're going back to this mifepristone ruling. Mm-hmm. When it comes to telehealth visits, mailing the drug, we'll be speaking to a provider in a few minutes, but I wonder if you've been speaking with doctors and providers in Massachusetts, which, you know, in some ways, at the very beginning when we were talking about abortion, felt really shielded from it, right?
Uh-huh.
What are they telling you, those providers and doctors, about their concerns and worries?
They're telling me they are alarmed. They are very glad to be living in Massachusetts, where our governor is doing everything she can to try to protect people here and to try to protect healthcare providers. Our state attorney general is clearly on their side. But they understand that they are under assault from an organized group that wants to ban abortion all across this country. They want to deny access everywhere in this nation. Mm. And the doctors I have spoken with, the healthcare providers I have spoken with, have this feeling of assault, and they are right to feel that way. This mifepristone decision, it reveals, first of all, how the extremists in this country are not satisfied with banning abortions in some states. They want to get rid of them everywhere. But secondly, it's about a judge who stepped up and said that he would substitute his own personal views for all of the scientific evidence, all of the testing, all of the work that had been done for 23 years over this drug, that he personally would just step in and toss all that out the window.
Then
the Fifth Circuit said, well, you know what? We won't toss it all out.
Right.
We'll just toss out the last 7 years of data and changes. We're not going to have
Senator?
Only politics.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. And I want to hone in on a point that you made, and that was abortion was sold by congressional Republicans as a state's rights issue. And I know a lot of people didn't buy it at the time, but it was the argument. With these court rulings with national impact, it seems really difficult to make that argument now. But I want to know, what are you hearing from your Republican colleagues? I imagine hopefully you have some conversations. The way they talk about that issue, did it change from states' rights issue?
Oh, it's now total silence. Mm. Now that it's starting to seep out what else is going on, the effort to ban abortion nationwide, I haven't heard one elected official in the United States Senate on the Republican side stand up and say the Texas court is wrong. the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is wrong. A court should not, cannot substitute its own personal views about abortion for scientific evidence and medical decisions that are none of that court's business.
When you say silent, do you mean they're kind of backing off? Because we've seen in so many states that this wasn't a winning issue for them. So is it kind of, have congressional lawmakers lost control of the abortion issue? Because so much of it now is being pushed by anti-abortion activists and courts. Have they just lost control?
Well, it's hard to say that, because they're actually still pursuing an anti-abortion expansion agenda. Look at where we were just this week. Senator Tuberville from Alabama has put a hold on every single military promotion at the top levels. All of those have to be voted on by the Senate. It's always done by consent. So when you're putting someone in to be the head of the 7th Fleet, there's a vote that happens, or someone who's going to be our representative to NATO. There's a vote that technically happens. And like I said, it's by unanimous consent. He is holding up right now 184 top military promotions. Why? Because he doesn't like the ruling that the military is now using to say if someone needs to leave the state where they are, someone who's an active duty military member, leave the state where they are to get medical treatment, reproductive health medical treatment, then they will be permitted to do that. Senator Tuberville doesn't like that because he thinks that means that there will be some active duty service members who will use that to leave a state that prohibits abortion, to go to a state that will permit abortion, and he wants to shut that down right now. That is a debate that took place on the floor of the United States Senate Thursday. It's still ongoing, so don't talk to me about the elected Republicans who've lost control of the narrative. They're still out there trying to push their anti-abortion agenda nationwide.
So I do want to talk about what's next, because some healthcare providers have said that any changes to the FDA, which is what the Supreme Court ruling could do tonight, it could be disastrous. And really, it could be just the beginning, impacting other drugs, birth control, medications for trans healthcare, gender reaffirming healthcare, other public drugs on the market for medication abortions. Are you concerned about this as well? Like, do you see it as the beginning of something?
Yes, I am very concerned. And I understand exactly why our healthcare providers are worried about this. This decision out of Texas and then the subsequent decision out of the Fifth Circuit is a court stepping in and substituting its own moral views about abortion for the scientific and medical information that is collected by the FDA. The FDA has made decisions about the safety of a drug based on years of data, based on information they gather. And here's a court that just steps in and says they see it differently, and they believe there are other risks, even though the data themselves don't show that. There's more risk of dying from taking Viagra than there is from dying from taking Mifepristone. Mm. And yet this court wants to step in and substitute its judgment. And if it can do it once, it can do it twice, it can do it 10 times, it can do it 100 times. And our whole system of an FDA that is independent, that follows the evidence, is out the window. And that puts all of us at risk.
So just on that, like, you and others in Congress, if that is likely to happen, what can you possibly do to protect access? Are you working on anything
well,
right now?
Our first step right now is through the courts, as you've rightly identified, and we'll see today what happens, and you rightly point out there are a lot of different directions the court could go. Our second is to, what I've been urging is for the administration to use the tools that are already in the system. The FDA still has a lot of legal tools available to us to keep mifepristone available whenever needed across the country. And it's important to pick up every one of those tools and use them. And there may be a place for Congress to try to strengthen those tools, but, you know, I have to be realistic here. With Republicans in control of the House, with a filibuster in the Senate, it's hard to see Congress strengthening access to abortion.
Well, Senator Warren,
when Republicans are hell-bent on banning access.
I appreciate you so much for being here. Thank you so much. That was Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
So, what does all of this mean on the ground for local providers? With me now to discuss that part of it is Christy Monast, Executive Director for HealthQ, a sexual and reproductive health clinic in Lawrence, Haverhill, and Beverly. Christy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Can I just start by asking you what your reaction to Senator Warren is?
I was silently cheering for all of the support and spot-on points that she was making. I would say that one of the things that stood out to me was the decision that came down saying this is about states and states having rights, and yet we're still being told how we have to practice our care clinically and how frustrating that is.
And you spoke to producer Amanda Beeland yesterday about this topic, and I want to know what this means for you and your staff here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, so it's been a little bit of a disruption or something that has frustrated us. We are rising to the challenge, as we always have and we always will, both here for my team at HealthQ and for my colleagues across the state, Commonwealth, and across the country. But we're frustrated because we are spending a lot of time focusing on talking with legal counsel, making contingency plans for various potential decisions that may come down. We have to update our staff. We have to educate our patients. And we should be spending 100% of our energy and attention to providing the essential high-quality patient care we do every day and our ongoing efforts to partner with our patients and communities to remove other barriers and inequities that our patients are experiencing so that no one is left behind in having the sexual and reproductive health they deserve.
So
we're rising to the challenge and we're frustrated.
And I want to talk through a couple of scenarios that might happen because the news is happening at a dizzying speed. So one being the removal of certain FDA approvals for mifepristone, including the ability to mail that drug to patients and have telehealth visits. What would that mean for your patients?
It would mean additional barriers to access. It would mean that they would not have the flexibility necessarily to get the abortion care in the way that works best for their lives. They may need to reschedule things that are in a typical day for them to come to a clinic visit. They may have less decision-making in how they want to experience their abortion and the autonomy and self-control to do it the way they want, where they want, and with the support system that they want.
So that one is a pretty straightforward decision. The other one could kind of leave you in limbo. It would be a ruling to send this case back to lower courts, prolonging that final decision. And I'm wondering what that limbo, what impact could it have on the services you provide? How effective would you be in being able to provide them?
Well, we know that we're providing abortion services regardless of the decisions that are coming down. We are very grateful to be in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, as the senator had said. And to have the unequivocal support we've been receiving from our governor, our legislators, and the Department of Public Health. So we know that we're still going to be providing abortion services. We know that we're still going to be providing medication abortions. We don't know exactly how that's going to look. And like you said, the dizzying speed, but also the little bit of the inchworm speed of we get a couple days and we're not sure where we're going the next day. But we are prepared to continue to provide services.
What would you say to somebody who makes the point that, like, you know, what's wrong with a little more regulation? We are talking about people's health here. That is the argument being made. Wouldn't more vigilance do nothing but support women more so than zooming in with this package of mifepristone that they received in the mail?
No. So let me be very clear and sort of echo some of what the senator was saying. The decision makers that are making these decisions are not making them on medicine or science-based information. They're making their decisions based on politics. And the history of all of this is based in the misogyny and the supremacy that our country's been in. And it's about controlling people and controlling their lives and their futures. So I see this as a significant problem.
And we did speak with a senator earlier about how this ruling, some health advocates say, could be the beginning of more restrictions on other ways to have medical care. And I'm wondering, in your mind, what those effects, like, what is that impact? Like, what else would it restrict?
Well, a lot of my colleagues, and especially those that are involved in the advocacy fight for the policies, continue to try to make the point of this is not just about abortion. This is about power, this is about control, and this is about taking away people's autonomy. And when it comes to sex, sex behaviors, sexuality, reproductive justice, losing any of our freedoms is just blatantly wrong.
Can I just ask about the personal impact on you and your staff? Can you talk about community support, but can you also talk about just like the mental health impact it has on providers? Are you seeing burnout? Are you seeing people just, you know, packing up and leaving altogether? I mean, what does this actually look like? I imagine it is being very frustrating to keep up with this news as a provider.
It is frustrating. I think I have a couple of points there. I may need to be reminded of that, but we are in healthcare. So first I want to say that take away sexual and reproductive health, we're in healthcare. And we have just come through and just about to come out of the pandemic status of just this life-altering event. And working in healthcare has been exhausting and hard to meet individual needs of the staff and the needs of our patients and communities. That aside, sexual and reproductive health care and abortion care, we've been fighting this fight for 50 years, right? Those of us that are in the community and have been doing it for a long time know that this is an ebbing and flowing work that we have committed ourselves to. So we are used to the fight.
We have to leave it right there, but I appreciate you so much. Christy Monast, Executive Director for HealthQ, thank you so much.
And thank you.
The first month revenue numbers for mobile sports betting in Massachusetts is out, and they are staggering. The report from the Massachusetts Gaming Commission says since March, mobile sports betting earned almost $550 million, and it generated over $9 million in tax revenue for the state. But not everyone is loving sports betting. Some athletes have mixed feelings about it and are even dealing with backlash, at times from angry bettors who lose money. So that raises the question, is legalized sports betting hurting players? So we're joined now by Professor Jake Zagorski of Boston University's Questrom School of Business to talk about the present and future of sports betting in the state. Hi.
Nice to be here, Yasmin.
I have to laugh because I have to mention that Professor Jay Sikorsky is actually my professor. I take his macroeconomics class, which is very fun. And we also have in the studio Dr. Gerald Reed in studio with us today. He's a licensed sports psychologist and professor also at Boston University. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
All right, let us talk about the latest figures. Jay, how did the first month of sports betting stack up to your expectations?
They blew it out of the water. I was not expecting Massachusetts bettors to bet more than $500 million. And that during March is amazing because sports betting was only legal from March 10th. We only got about 3 weeks out of March. Imagine what would happen if we had the extra 10 days. But what's really important to understand is while bettors, bet so much money, the state only picked up $9 million in tax revenue. We were promised an incredible windfall from sports betting. Now let's take $9 million and multiply it and come up with a yearly figure. That means the state's going to get about $100 million. And to the average listener, $100 million sounds like a lot of money. I know I could certainly live quite well on $100 million.
Yeah, I think anybody could. Most people could. But let me ask you, like, what were you expecting? What were you expecting? Because the state said something like $60 million a year. And now we're talking $100 million. So what were your expectations versus, like, what actually happened?
I was expecting something like what the state was expecting. I figure maybe half this much.
Half this much. Wow.
Now, March is an important month for betting because that's college basketball. It's March Madness. And there's two really big events that drive sports betting. One is the Super Bowl, and the other is March Madness. Those are the two big events people really like to bet on. Think about all those office pools. But what I want to do is I want to shift the conversation just for a second, because $100 million seems like a lot of money, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But Governor Healey just released her proposed budget for Massachusetts, and that's $56 billion, with a B, billion dollars. $100 million in revenue? It's a drop in the bucket. It's not something that will be meaningful for providing revenue for Massachusetts programs.
So you're just saying, zoom out, and it is a drop in the bucket. But so understood. But Gerald, can I bring you in here? Not everyone is loving sports betting. Ex-star Kyrie Irving even claimed last month on a Twitch live stream that legalized betting is ruining sports. Because of the harassment players have faced from bettors. Take a listen.
You gambling. You gonna win or lose. But that doesn't mean sliding into people's DMs or wishing bad on them or doing the extra that goes on, man. It blows my mind sometimes.
So Irving's not the only pro athlete that's had a problem with betting. Last month, a fan allegedly shouted at fellow NBA star Bradley Beal for not helping the fan win his $1,300 bet, leading to an altercation. An NFL star, Calvin Ridley, is coming off of a one-year ban for betting on games. And just in the last few minutes before I even had you in the studio, NFL.com reports that five NFL players are being suspended for violating rules that prohibit players from gambling. And some of those suspensions will be at least for a full season. So all of this to ask you, this is happening. We live in an era of legal betting. How do you think these things may be affecting athletes with sports betting becoming more prevalent?
Yeah, you know, I get some insight into what it's like to be an athlete because I work with them, you know, my practice. And I don't only see them when they get to the elite level, but I also see when they get up to that level growing as a child into an adult, young adult, college. And look, they're human. And I think it's a missed aspect of fans watching sports is that they are human and they are sometimes dehumanized about how they're looked at because they're considered kind of like a piece to a puzzle, right? Even fans will say, oh, we have a missing piece to our team. We got to bring in a piece. That piece is a human being, right? And so the way that we look at it, especially when money's involved, money is a very emotional trigger for people. And when money's involved, it's, you know, that's a big risk right there. And you look at fans, as you mentioned, alcohol's involved and money's involved, two huge triggers for becoming very aggressive towards people. And that's the risk. You know, I'm always looking at risk because I see it. I see both sides. I see people who are addicted to things and have a hard time controlling impulses. And I see the other side of it, how it affects other people. And so, you know, it definitely concerns me because I see it. And I think a lot of times with gambling, people aren't as concerned about it because they haven't seen the aftermath of it. Some people have, and it makes them very keenly aware of the downsides of it. And if you don't see it, if you don't experience it, you know, it's kind of like when you're an adolescent, you know, you think that the risks are there, but it's not going to happen to me. I'm going to do it. It's not going to happen to me.
I'm going to come back to that. But in case you're just joining us, we are talking to Professor or Dr. Gerald Reed. He's a sports psychologist and professor at Boston University. And we're also talking to Jay Zagorski, who is a professor at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. I want you, so coming back to you, Dr. Reed, I want to ask, can you help us experience that? When you said people don't really understand the human on the other side, do you have any examples or any way for us who don't know, who just look at sports betting as like a money issue, help us experience what you mean?
Completely. Look, if you're going to become an elite athlete, you have to, in some ways, become a perfectionist. And being a perfectionist means that it's never enough. You're always trying to push yourself to get better and to do better. Not only that, your self-worth could be attached to that. Even take a step further, you are always trying to please people, your coaches, your parents, you know, the pressures of the media, the pressures of contracts, endorsements. You know, you're always trying to please people and impress people. And think about how much pressure that is. Think about it. We don't think about it because we're obsessed with the winning and the losing, and then gambling's involved. You're really obsessed with that winning and losing. You lose touch with the process of the person's life. And that pressure is very important. We don't realize the pressure until people break down. And oftentimes people get help afterwards, after the fact. And so, you know, there's a fragility to athletes that we don't realize because there's so much pressure to it. And when you have the added pressure of someone else gambling on you, and that's an unwanted relationship, these athletes are not asking for people to gamble on them. It's not like they're asking for this relationship to exist, but it becomes a relationship. Mm. And a very pressured-filled relationship where people are angry at you. And
it's another thing that they tie to their self-worth.
It very much could be, and just the pressure of trying to please everyone and for people to be upset with them. Athletes, elite athletes, they don't want people to be upset with them. They may not admit it because they project mental toughness and that they don't care. Believe me, people care. I see it. I hear about it. They care. They're sensitive. They're human.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking us behind the scenes there. It is worth mentioning, not every athlete has a problem with sports betting. I want you to hear from ex-Patriots legend Rob Gronkowski, who's doing a Super Bowl commercial for FanDuel.
Gronk speaking.
Gronky baby, how does a FanDuel Super Bowl commercial sound?
Great. What do I got to do?
FanDuel is putting up a $10 million payout when you kick a field goal during the Super Bowl.
Wait, I don't kick, I catch.
Kick, catch, who cares? It's football.
Oh my God, I've watched that commercial so many times I could practically recite it. But I wanna ask, it's not unusual for athletes to have fantasy sports teams. How much are companies counting on athletes to lend their credibility to legal betting? And Jay, I want to turn to you for that question.
I don't know the answer to that one. But what's really important is that when we have all these fantasy things, people like to bet only on a few areas. For example, they like to bet on football, baseball, and basketball. Those are the three big ones. And if we look at Nevada statistics, 93% of all bets happen in those three areas. Now, what Gerald was just talking about is pressure on all kinds of athletes because we've opened up a can of worms. The Mass Gaming Commission has allowed us to bet on almost everything. You can legally bet, if they're willing to make an offer, and I'll give you a line, on Ultimate Frisbee. It's a team sport. Badminton. While I understand there's pressure on all kinds of athletes, maybe we can control it and just give it for the three big things that people want to bet on, baseball, basketball, and football, and not provide all this pressure for athletes in things like badminton, which are legal in Massachusetts to bet on, online or in person.
Are you saying it just takes the fun out of the games or infuses these games with danger? I'm just curious how, like, you think they should, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission basically should just consider banning anything other than those three big ones.
One of the big ideas here is something called responsible gambling.
Mm.
And the question is, in the quest for revenue, have we gone too far? Have we opened up a Pandora's box of problems ranging from excessive pressure on athletes to a sort of a quest going for every last dime of tax revenue? And maybe we'll come back in a couple of years and say, you know, online betting, giving people the power to pull the phone out of their pocket and bet at any moment and have no impulse control is not the best thing in the world, just because we're hoping to get a couple more dollars to fund other things in the state of Massachusetts.
So there you go. Economist Jay Zagorski says it is not all about money all the time. So I'll turn to Gerald. We've talked about gambling addiction being a concern for bettors, with sports betting now legal, but do those issues extend to fans' relationships? You mentioned how it extends to fans' relationships with athletes. Like, how do you think going forward fans are going to view athletes differently?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better the more pervasive it becomes. You know, there's even high school students gambling, like in class. I hear about it. You know, they got their phones out. They're like, oh, I just made a bet, you know, and they're not even of legal age to do that.
I have to say that just gave me a really visceral reaction. I'm not going to lie.
Right. And look, I mean, you know, I always want to acknowledge the pros and cons of things that happen. And I just am biased towards the downsides of things because I just see the aftermath of it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that could be done to help the athletes themselves. And I can get into that if you like.
Well, let me ask you this. The Massachusetts Gaming Commission has heard from professional players associations who do want regulations in place to prohibit people from making threats against players and their families. Is there anything meaningful in your mind the commission can do to protect players from harassment?
That's a tricky one, right? You know, the internet is the Wild West and people say what they want. And I've done research in bullying too, in cyberbullying, and there's just this anonymity of not being able to see, not face to face. When you're not face to face with someone, people are willing to say anything. That's scary, right? You feel like you can say whatever you want, and you're not face to face to confront the person. You know, people really say they really have crossed the line more over the years because of the internet and the way that things are done. And I'm not really sure, you know, what could be done about it. You know, my job as a psychologist is to try to help people in the individual level to support them through it. And I do the best I can to do that and to help people cope with it and to overcome these pressures and these, in some ways, traumas, right? If someone's harassing you online, that's pretty traumatic for someone. You know, you don't even know where they are. You can feel threatened in a lot of ways. It's a scary thing.
And Jay, do you have any thoughts on what the Massachusetts Gaming Commission can do besides maybe stop betting on some sports?
So one of the things they can do is stop betting on some sports. But the other thing is that right now, at least the March statistics, only 3% of bets were placed in face-to-face situations. 97% was online. And we can actually try and switch that around. Sports betting, I think, is a fine idea with limits. But maybe you have to go to Plain Ridge. Maybe you have to go to Encore to actually place your bets. This idea of giving high school students the ability to pull a phone out of their pocket and make bets during lunch hour, even that just doesn't sound like the right thing to do.
Put up more guardrails. That was Jay Zagorski, professor at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. Thank you for joining us.
Great being here.
Dr. Gerald Reed, sports psychologist professor, also at Boston University. Lovely to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.